This is an ABC podcast.
My guest on Conversations today is Samantha Wheeler. Sam has two daughters. And when her youngest, Charlotte, was 14, she was diagnosed with Rett syndrome. And this diagnosis explained all the things that Charlotte had been struggling with. Her clumsiness and hand clenching, her tantrums, and her inability to speak. But it still left Sam in the dark about what her daughter could understand and what she wanted to say. Sam writes books for kids, and her new novel imagines what it might be like to have Rett syndrome, to be the person trapped on the inside. It's called Everything I've Never Said. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sarah.
Let's start back at the beginning of Charlotte's life. What was her birth like?
Well, Charlotte was born at 27 weeks, and back then, because now she's 21, 27 weeks was the knife edge of, goodness, will this little one survive or not? And so I'd already had one daughter who was two, well, not quite two at the time. So that birth had gone quite well, so I had assumed birth number two would be easy peasy. But then at 27 weeks, this little baby decided she wanted to come. And so I had to have an emergency cesarean, and then Charlotte was born at 840 grams.
So what does that look like?
Yeah, so she was about the length of a pen. And her dad was able to slip his wedding ring over her arm, completely up her arm. So she was a tiny little froggy thing, but she was apparently quite strong and she was doing quite well. But this little inner feeling you have in your heart, oh, 27 weeks is so little.
What did the doctors give as her prognosis?
Doctors were amazingly positive. We were down in South Australia at the time, so the Women's and Children's Hospital there are very, very experienced. They have, you know, this amazing intensive care unit with all these success story pictures along the hallway to get there. And they all said to me, look at these pictures. Your daughter's going to be fine. There was never a murmur that she wouldn't be anything but fine.
And did you have confidence in that yourself?
I didn't believe it, and I don't know why. I had a couple of friends who'd had preemie babies who said, you know, we've had no ongoing problems. But she was so tiny. It was hard to believe she'd have a complete bill of health.
Mm. How long did she have to stay in hospital until you could bring her home, Sam?
It was about 3 months, but it was staggered. So, for example, they have the intensive care where you've got lots of machines beeping and they're in the tiny little enclosed crib. Then they go to an open crib where there's other babies and there's not so many things beeping. And then we were able to bring her to our local hospital because we lived in the Barossa Valley. We're an hour and a half from the Women's and Children's. So when she was nearly ready to come home, maybe about a month before she came home, she was moved to our local hospital. So all up 3 months and in different places. And it's quite funny, you become very attached to the safety of hospital. It was quite hard to leave hospital. I've got a fabulous picture of Beth the day we bring Charlotte home. My mum-in-law's home with her. I walk in the door with the famous capsule and Beth's face is bright red and she's screaming. And it's typical of that two-year-old going, hey, competition? No thanks.
I liked it when she was in the hospital.
Yeah.
We could go and visit.
Oh, it's so funny.
So she managed to pass all those milestones so that it was safe for her to come home. But when did you as her mum start noticing that she was maybe developing differently than, say, your elder daughter?
Yeah. Well, originally I was trying to be very positive. So at the point when she came home, say that's, you know, roughly zero potentially. And then, you know, at about 6 months, there should be a little bit of effort to maybe be sitting up and maybe to start looking at crawling at 8 months, 9 months. Around that 8, 9 months time, I went, she's not even trying to roll over and crawl. Then she started pulling herself along on her bottom, which a lot of babies do. So then that was, yes, I was wrong. I'm being paranoid. She's fine. And then about a year, they should be really pulling themselves up for walking, and definitely no walking, no strength in her legs at all. And her feet were quite splayed. So we were sort of blaming maybe her feet were very little and that's why. But that inner little voice was saying, it's not that, it's not that.
Did you talk to doctors about your fears?
Yes, I did. And I think that there are a lot of mums who are very worried about the tiniest detail of their baby's development. And I think the doctors are very experienced at calming you down. So originally it was because she was born so preemie. You know, at 6 months, you're just at age, you know, it's usual for these to be a little delayed. And then at a year, she's not walking. Well, maybe her sister brings her everything she needs. So why would she walk? So we had a lot of it explained away. You know, look at her. She looked healthy. She looked normal. She had beautiful blonde curly hair, so she was a pretty little thing. So to be worried about those seemed incidental. Like, don't worry.
Was she a happy baby?
I think she was a frustrated baby. She was showing signs of being a frustrated person. So I think maybe if you didn't have a disability, you were able to perhaps grasp at things or make yourself understood. But I felt always with her that there was something blocking me from her telling me what she wanted. So she would pinch a lot and scream and bite a lot. And we explained that away as well.
So what was she like as a toddler? How did she engage with you and with other little kids?
She didn't really know. It was like she didn't really know the socially appropriate way to engage. I think we rely a lot on, even if you see a little one, I take my dogs for walks, and one of them's a pug, Maggie, and she's cute, and she wears this little pink little jacket thing. And little babies in their prams will try and say the word dog, and whether they come out with it or not, it's their version of dog, and they say it about 20 times, you know. Well, Charlotte wouldn't say anything, and I think as a result, then her frustration would develop, and then she'd take that out on us a little bit. So you'd maybe reach down to say, look, Charlotte, a dog, and she'd pull your hair. Which babies pull your hair, but it was a bit more than that.
So did she have any words at all as a toddler?
She used to say mum a lot, and she still actually can say mum occasionally. And she'd say more when she wanted a drink or food to start with. She'd say a few words like that, and she used to say dad as well, but never two words together. Not babbling, really. Not like mum, 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 not like that.
And doctors didn't think that was a cause for concern either?
No, they thought that perhaps preemie baby again, and also maybe overzealous mother and perhaps sister talking for her, and that's why she didn't.
How was Charlotte with babysitters when you'd leave her with other people?
Well, when I had Charlotte, I was working and I was really enjoying my job, so I thought, oh, well, I'll just have, you know, 9 months off and I'll go back to my job. And I found family daycare was the best option because it was a smaller, less sensory, overloady sort of environment. And that didn't go too well because she would bite and hair pull the other kids. But I did find an amazing lady in the Barossa who cared for Charlotte and just coped with all of that. You know, just never sort of said, oh, look at the scratches on my baby's arms because of your daughter. She'd just say, oh, well, we had fun in the sandpit today.
Yeah. You did decide to move back to be closer to family.
Yes.
In Brisbane. And and when you got to Brisbane, Charlotte got a diagnosis. What did doctors suggest might be going on?
Yeah, well, when we came to Brisbane, she was about three, not long off maybe being four, and we were looking towards schooling. You know, where would she go to school? Do we need to book her in anywhere? And very clearly, the non-speaking and this explosive behaviour when she didn't get what she wanted was a cause for concern. And also her walking was really unsteady. So we started off going to different paediatricians, and then we were referred to the Mater. And doctors sort of said it was a bit of a mystery, and perhaps the best explanation would be that she had autism. But we always felt a little concerned about that because she does enjoy the company of others. Although she can't do that properly, you know, she'll hurt you and she doesn't mean to. She does want to be with you. She didn't want to be in another world. She wanted to be in this world.
So what do you think was suggesting to doctors autism? Was it?
I think the sensory stuff. So, for example, you remember the days where Maccas used to have playrooms and you'd have birthday parties? Well, everyone seemed to have birthday parties in a playroom. And honestly, it was a disaster. And the number of times we clutched her in a rugby hold and, you know, raced out the door. And so we'd tell them things like that and they'd say, oh, you know, people with autism suffer from these sort of sensory issues. It probably is a level of that. So we enrolled her in Autism Queensland and they did a lot of work on the sensory things. They also tried really hard to help her communicate. So they had a system where they'd print out little cards with pictures and then those pictures would have to get picked up. So if you wanted a drink, you'd pick up the picture of a drink and hand it to the carer. But Charlotte was never able to coordinate her hand and her thought. It's called apraxia, where there's a delay in what you want to do and what your muscles then do. So she could take 2 or 3 minutes to pick up that card, if at all. Maybe she couldn't pick it up. And so they would just assume she just didn't have the capacity to communicate.
And when you and her carers saw her around children who had a diagnosis of autism, I mean, did she seem similar to those kids?
She seemed similar when things weren't going well, if that makes sense. So going, if you've ever seen a two-year-old lose it in a shopping centre and they just are inconsolable, well, to have a six-year-old act in the same way, perhaps if a baby cries or someone plays bagpipes, or one of the things that used to set her off was Christmas paper being unwrapped. So I'd look at other children with autism or on the spectrum in some way and I'd go, you know what? They don't like those sounds, and Charlotte doesn't like those sounds, and she doesn't like the slippery surfaces in bathrooms. They don't like that either. Must be autism.
How capable was she physically as she was getting to those sort of, 7 and 8? What was happening with her physical abilities?
Yeah. Well, to start with, she could walk, and she'd walk with quite a wide gait. So she eventually, after lots of physio from that two-year-old who couldn't walk, could begin to walk, and she'd hold her feet out really far apart. She'd find it very hard to walk when shoes were on because that would change the way her feet would angle. So she'd fall over a lot, and she was quite clumsy. And we used to find that she would find it difficult, for example, to get on and off a chair. And so we would sort of, you know, she's little, we could just pick her up and put her on the chair. So the physical side of it didn't match that autism diagnosis, but it wasn't as noticeable until maybe her early teens, when she was taller, and you'd look at her walking or losing the ability to walk or losing the ability to get up and down off her bed, for example, or a chair, and say, this autism thing is just not fitting well. But certainly by the time she was 8, she was spending a lot of time wringing her hands. And people have trouble imagining what that might look like, but I kind of explain it that you've got maybe a face washer in your hands and you're squeezing the water out of it. That's sort of what her hand wringing looks like. They're squashing her palms together.
And did that seem to be related to distress or emotion, or was it almost like not in her control when she was doing that?
A little bit of both. Excited, she'd start to do it. Stress, definitely, but mostly stress would be then to bite her hands. She would bite the back of her hands to the point of making them bleed. But the squishiness of her hands together was just almost like an automatic, almost as automatic as blinking.
I'm trying to imagine your family life, Sam, where you've got these two little girls and one girl who's got these behaviours and is having physical difficulty and not verbal, and just what daily life must have been like. I mean, what was it like going to the shops, for example?
Horrendous. Horrendous. But you know what? A sense of humour is a really, really important thing in these times. And I think one of the things that having a girl like Charlotte in my life has taught me is to care less about what people think. And we're so head up worrying about what everyone thinks of us when everyone else is worrying about what everyone thinks of them. I remember going to Logan Home Shopping Centre with her when she was about 6. And so Beth would have been 8 and all very embarrassed about what people were doing and looking at us. And Charlotte had a strawberry milkshake, and she was in a pram because still at 6 you can, you know, get away with her being in a pram. She's only little. So she had this strawberry milkshake wedged in between her legs, and somebody's baby started crying in the food court, and she just picked up this milkshake and tossed it at this baby, and it just went all over the baby and the mum, and you just don't know what to do. Do you go and apologise, or do you run? What do you do? Yeah, well, we just quickly turned the other way, but people then stopped us and said, children like yours shouldn't be allowed out. And so for me, that was like, oh, go away. But for Beth, who's 8, those memories really sank hard with her, you know. It's like my sister. They're talking about my sister.
You're saying that you could say as an adult, I'll go away. But that must have been challenging for you as a parent.
I think two things really helped me was, one, I love animals. So we have a lot of animals. So we've always lived on acreage. So the peace and quiet of animals and the calm of being away from shopping centres and having, you know, even that time when we went to Logan Home, you come home and you've got your horses in the paddock. What people think of you doesn't matter when you've got those animals in your life. But I think the other thing that kind of helps is you can avoid those things if you I could say, right, I'm not going to go to the shops. But the trouble with that is then you start isolating yourself. And I see that in other mums with children with disabilities, is the easiest way to cope is to say, I just won't do that. I won't go to that dinner party. I won't go to the shops. I certainly won't go to that birthday party. And so you can make your life easier, but it's quite lonely because you're not going out and about.
When Charlotte was still sort of primary age and all you had to go on was this diagnosis of autism, which didn't feel like it quite fitted, did you and her dad have a similar approach to managing Charlotte's behaviour, say those tantrums?
I think that was a very tough one, and I think a lot of families would relate to dad needing to be the disciplinarian often, or one of the parents being the disciplinarian and one of the parents being the sort of methodical distractor, if you like. Oh, well, quickly, let's go and do something else.
Did he see it as a behavioural
thing?
Yes,
and a lot of times, and I really take my hat off to parents with children on the spectrum with autism, there's a lot of stigma with the behaviour of people with autism, that it's fixable. And therefore, if they have a problem with sensory things, like taking them to a shopping centre and the lights, the fluoro lights, are difficult for them, well, you need to take them to that shop lots of times, or you need to desensitise them, or you need to plan ahead, or you need to write out a card system of we'll go here. So as a parent, there's a huge amount of guilt that the behaviour is actually your fault. You didn't plan well enough, or you took them to the shopping centre on a Thursday when it was noisier. So I think as a mum, I tended to try and plan avoidance strategies. I think her dad tended to say, but this is who she is and we've got to live our life. Let's just go and do it anyway. And if her behaviour then skyrocketed as a mum, I would think, oh, come on, let's just quickly go. Whereas he would say, let's make sure she doesn't do this behaviour again. I think it's a really tough area for all parents.
Did it lead to conflict between you and your husband?
In the early days, it probably did. But I also think that then what happens, and perhaps happens to a lot of families, is that one of the parents then decides, well, the other parent can just do it then. My way isn't working, and it wasn't. None of our ways was working to control her behaviour or help her communicate. I think one parent then just sort of maybe shrugs it off and says, well, look, you do it then. Because obviously everything I'm doing is a failure and I'm not being able to make a difference. And I think that's where we probably saw differently. I was still in, let's fix this, whereas perhaps he was, this is who she is.
What about things with Charlotte's sister, with Beth? What were things like between them?
Yes, well, I've struggled to understand that myself. And I've said to Beth, to be honest with me, and she's blown me away with what she says. I say to her, you know, would you have liked it if Charlotte was normal? And she'd say, Charlotte's Charlotte, Mum. She's my sister and I love her. I think she was embarrassing to have as a sister, but never once did Beth say to me, please don't bring her to my school concert. I wouldn't bring her because I know what would happen, but Beth, that didn't come from Beth ever. She probably did more what I did, which was the avoidance, not bringing friends home, perhaps meeting friends at their home. But she loves her sister and she still loves her very much. She's not a hands-on sister, so she doesn't come over now and take her out to the movies, but she watches her sister's back.
You talked about the carers at the Autism Association trying to use cards or help her communicate with cards. How effective was that for her?
It was hopeless. She got so frustrated. And I think what would happen is, given her best intentions, say, for example, one of the choices of the card was chocolate and one was water. If she wanted to choose chocolate, she'd look at the card for chocolate and maybe her hand was trying to reach for the card for chocolate and she'd by mistake get the one for water. It was enormously frustrating for her. And I think that it got to the point if you put the cards out, she would just swipe them completely off the table. She wouldn't even look at them or want to touch them.
Did that leave you thinking, well, maybe she doesn't want to communicate, maybe she's not capable?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think so. And I think that I then just started making her decisions for her. You look tired, off you go to bed. You want another movie? Great, let's put it on. She wasn't able to make any choices. I was doing it all for her.
You went on a camp with Charlotte when she was 12 and had an insight there into what she might be capable of. What happened?
I loved that day. It was wonderful. So I can't remember who suggested that we go, and I have a feeling it might have been the speech therapist that we were seeing at the time who was struggling to help us with this card system. And she said, you know, Charlotte might be able to make some friends, and why don't you take her? And it's at Tambourine Mountain, and it'll be a range of different children with different disabilities, and you stay, I think, 2 nights. And I thought, oh, my goodness, she's just going to lose the plot. I can't stay. One of the things she didn't ever like was toilets that weren't our own toilet. So 2 nights, no. Well, we'll just go for the day, expecting that maybe it wouldn't go very well, which is horrible. But anyway, off we trotted, popped her in the car. One of the things that used to happen in the car, if she didn't want to go where you'd said you were going, she'd lean forward and pull my hair. I always used to wear my hair in a ponytail. So you'd be driving along with this child clinging onto your ponytail, and I was so nearly going to turn around and go back. And I thought, oh, no, this is going to be terrible. Anyway, we get out of the car, and suddenly her demeanour changes. She looks around to see who else is there. And even though I remember so clearly the particular place was on a bit of a slope and she doesn't walk confidently, she's clumsy, and I was helping her down this slope and she was making a beeline for this boy, and he was in a wheelchair, an automatically driven wheelchair, and he had a little kind of little iPad-y computer on the wheelchair, and then a little button just near, I think, his hand or his elbow. I can't really remember. Anyway, so she kind of pulled me towards this boy and we stood in front of him, and he said, "Hi, you want to hear a joke?" But he didn't say it with his mouth. He communicated through pressing the words out by using his hand on this little button that then spoke the words. So I said, "Yeah, oh, we'd love to hear a joke. I'd love to be able to tell you what the joke was." But anyway, he told the joke through this machine, and Charlotte laughed, and I looked at Charlotte and she looked at me and we looked at the boy and we went, "There has to be another way."
So what was it that was so important about that moment to you, Sam? What did it spark in you?
I think that this little boy was far more physically disabled than my daughter, and he had the sense of communication so strongly inside of him that he was able to tell us a joke, and yet from the outside you wouldn't even assume he had the mental capacity to tell you the time of day or say hello. You know, I was not expecting him to even say hello. Not only did he say hello, but he told us a funny joke and then he asked us if we wanted to hear another one. So judging him from the outside would assume he didn't have anything to say. Judging Charlotte from the outside, you'd probably say maybe she has, but he was someone who looked like he really wouldn't be able to say even hello, and he could do better than that.
When you saw Charlotte's reaction, do you think she clocked that as a significant moment for you too?
Possibly, yes. And I would say now, I mean, back then she was younger, but nearly 10 years wiser than I am, I would say she went, "See, Mum, look at that. Come on, get your act together."
So what led to you finally getting a definitive diagnosis for your daughter?
So this day, Charlotte was enrolled in a special school and had been for a number of years. And I went to pick her up on the, I think, the last Friday of term. And one of the other mums saw me in the car park and she said, "Oh, you're Charlotte's mum." I said, "Yeah, hi." And we introduced ourselves. And she said, "Have a look at my daughter." And I had a look at her daughter and I said, "Yeah." And she said, "You don't think your daughter has the same disability as my daughter?" And I said, "Oh, what's your daughter got?" And she said, "Well, she's got Rett syndrome." And she started to explain Rett syndrome. And I said, "No, actually, Charlotte has autism." And she said, "I think you need to go and see my GP. And I said, "Oh, okay, why would you say that?" And she said, "You're going to get a blood test. And if she's got Rett syndrome, the whole way that you would treat her would be different to how you would treat her if she had autism. Why don't you just go along and have the blood test? Here's his number." So she wrote it down on a piece of paper. We ummed and ahed about it. We went and got an appointment, one blood test, and 2 days later, we realised she didn't have autism and she'd never had autism.
Sam, after 14 years of not knowing, you suddenly get a blood test that says she has this condition. What is Rett syndrome?
Well, it's a tricky one because it's so rare, Sarah. It's affecting probably about 400 girls in Australia as we speak. So to have only 400 affected, you can see why the paediatricians and the doctors didn't recognise it. But basically what it is the X chromosome has a number of places where you have a lineup of bases, and they've all got special long names, but that lineup of bases should be a particular way. And sometimes you can have a mutation that causes one or the other to change their order. And that order could be changed in one of six places. And if it's been changed in a particular way in one of those six places, a blood test can very clearly show that that mutation has happened. Now back, well, Charlotte was born in 97. I think the blood test only came about in early 2000. So, you know, when she was a young baby, there's no way we would know. And you have to actually go looking for that
because
change.
It's not inherited if it's a genetic
mutation. No, that's right. It's not inherited. It's happened at birth. It is highly usual for it to be confused with autism. But how it looks genetically is very, very different. So it's just this one little place on the X chromosome that's changed. And it can be changed in six ways. So some girls, for example, have a lot of seizures. And they can have, you know, 140 seizures a day, some of them. Some girls have no ability to swallow naturally, so they have a peg by which they're fed. And then you have the very other end of the spectrum where there are some girls who can walk unassisted and can talk as well. So Charlotte is somewhere in between. So she has about the middle mutation, which means she very, very thankfully doesn't have seizures, but it does mean she has scoliosis, which is a twist in the spine. She has small feet and she has this wringing of the hands, which really most of the girls have. But nearly all of the girls have in common a desire to be with others and very bright, shiny eyes that take in everything.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanofsky on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
You'd mentioned earlier, Sam, apraxia.
Yes.
What is that?
I know that I'd heard about it when she had autism, but I didn't really understand it. And I understand it now. And what it means is if I was to want to wiggle my big toe, my brain would send a message to my big toe so quickly that I wouldn't even realize that it was happening. But when you have apraxia, you could ask your brain to wiggle your big toe and there may be a 5-minute delay. So I imagine from seeing videos of people who've had strokes that that's a similar thing, that if they want to learn to walk again, they actually have to train the brain to talk to the muscles.
And, of course, why trying to communicate with cards wouldn't work because there'd be a lag even if she could pick up that card physically.
Yes. And also it comes and goes. So that incident of her throwing the milkshake, a lot of people would say, how come she could pick up that milkshake that day? Well, it could be that maybe 50 other times she's tried to throw a milkshake. It just happened that that was the day it all came together for her. Or, you know, she can pull my hair really quickly too. You know, so I think the apraxia comes and goes.
Mm. Does the condition affect cognitive function? Does it affect her brain?
That's a tricky one. And I've spoken to a lot of other mums and also to professionals about that. It's very easy to say yes to that and say, of course, it affects every other muscle and organ in the body. But the thing is, how would we ever know? Until she can communicate properly, we're really only guessing what her ability is. I would hazard a guess that it's a lot better than what we think. And similar to that young man that we saw that day on Tambourine Mountain, I definitely don't think you can judge by her outward look. You know, she dribbles and she often has a slack look on her face. But then you might say something like, oh, mum's coming over later, just to somebody else in the family. And she knows that means her grandma's coming over, who she loves. And she'll look and she'll start looking towards the door. So she doesn't miss a thing. So the level of impairment is very difficult to judge.
Do the symptoms tend to get more severe over time for girls? And it's mainly girls who have Rett syndrome.
The answer to that is yes. So what generally happens is they can often look normal for the first 2 or 3 years of life. In Charlotte's case, not so much, but a lot of young girls' mums say they did. And then they'll suddenly start changing and regressing a little bit. So they may have had words and they lose them. They may have had walking and they may lose that. And then that sort of plateaus out. And then once they reach their teens, they have another developmental change where they might lose the ability to walk completely, which is pretty much where Charlotte is. She cannot walk unassisted anymore, and she used to be able to. And then that generally plateaus off. They did used to think that children with Rett syndrome didn't live past 16. But now with this blood test, I've met mums of girls with Rett syndrome who are 60. So you're able to prove someone's got Rett syndrome, so therefore you can check people who may have previously gone under the radar. So degenerative, yes, but not necessarily a shorter life or a much shorter life.
And is there any cure on the horizon?
Yeah, great question. That's the million-dollar question. because it's the X chromosome and women have two, they're working on a cure whereby they'll turn off the faulty one and we'll operate on the good one. And they've been able to do it successfully with rats. But I think we're a long way off.
How did getting that diagnosis change things for you and for Charlotte's dad?
I think it helped enormously. It was a life-changing moment. For one thing, we weren't addressing very much of her physical disability at all. And Rett syndrome comes with scoliosis, it comes with this apraxia. We were addressing sensory issues, behavioural issues. We were going to physiotherapists, but not really concentrating on keeping her comfortable in a chair, for example, when you've got scoliosis, just sitting's uncomfortable.
So she would have been in pain in a way you guys weren't aware.
All the time. And we had no idea. No idea. And sleeping is affected by Rett syndrome, and we had no idea that some days just letting her stay in bed was a good option and not forcing her to do her normal activities. So I think what we did was we accepted our girl for who she was. Instead of trying to fix her, we said, this is who you are. I think it helped our relationship with her a lot, but it also probably helped our relationship between her dad and I to be able to say, it's not our fault. We can let go of trying to fix our daughter.
Trying to help your daughter communicate had been such a big thing for you when you were under this wrong umbrella of autism. Mm. Once you get the diagnosis of Rett's, what did that mean for how you went about trying to help her communicate?
We were gentler on her. We let her get away with more stuff, probably, whereas when we thought it was autism, we thought it was our job to iron out these behavioural problems. I think what happened then is if she did just want to flop around on the couch, we would say, okay, not, you know, right, well, ready in 5 minutes, we're going. So we allowed her physically to relax a little bit. And I think as a result, a lot of that frustration that she was feeling settled, because we were able to say, maybe she doesn't like this because her back's hurting. Whereas previously we were saying, oh, we need to expose her to this more and fix this behaviour. But we didn't really then try any other communication methods. A lot of the other mums were struggling like we were. There wasn't at that stage the technology that there is today. There was a machine called a Dynavox that we hired for a while, and that had little buttons, but again, she needed to press them. A bit like the boy in that automatic chair, he pressed a button to talk and tell us that joke. A lot of the devices required a finger press or an elbow press or a cheek press. And with apraxia, she was unable to do that successfully.
So what technology can help?
Well, the latest technology is the exciting stuff. But what we did was realise that you could do simple things. So we bought a couple of whiteboards and we would draw a picture of a David Attenborough DVD, say a bird, and write the word David. And then we would draw a picture of maybe Ed Sheeran with his curly hair. And don't laugh because they're pretty bad. So then we would hold up those two alternate pictures and she would use her eyes to choose between them. It's ridiculous.
Did she ever choose David Attenborough over Ed Sheeran?
No, Ed Sheeran is the winner by a long shot. But I think even that, I think that it seems so obvious to tell you that, Sarah.
So it's just as simple as where she trains her gaze.
Yes.
You understand that's what she's choosing.
That's what she's choosing.
Can you tell, is she choosing because of the picture that you've drawn or the word that you've written or the fact that you've said Ed or David, or
all of them,
all of
which
that.
Is a surprise. So, for example, if I was just to write Ed, I do actually say, in this hand I've got Ed and in this hand I've got David. If I was to swap them and then just hold them up just with the words, she would be able to choose. It sounds obvious, doesn't it, when I say it, but, do you know, we never really realised she was using her eyes. And I think the reason is that unless you hold things far apart, you can't tell where someone's eyes are really looking. And I think we were, say with these cards, we were giving her choices of 10. Well, if someone's going to look at a 3 centimetre by 3 centimetre card versus the one next to it, you can't really tell. So we just assume she wasn't. But if we hold those 3 centimetre by 3 centimetre cards wide apart, she is lightning fast with her choices, and she's unforgiving. If you didn't see it the first time, Mum, I'm not bothering. I'm not going to do it again.
What if she doesn't want either Ed or David, but I don't know, The Sound of Music? How does she communicate another option?
Well, we have the option that if she looks in the middle at us, that's something different. And that is a never-ending thing, because what if she doesn't want David or Ed? What if she wants to go to the shops, actually? She doesn't want to stay home today, thanks. It's not as simple as just, you know, pink or purple. It's a lot of choices. And also the ability to comment. How about, I've got a headache? That's not in Ed or David Attenborough. So the something different then leads you to, oh, okay, well, what about this? And it can be a long process.
So what technology have you and other parents of Rett syndrome sufferers found that kind of does that creative options, I guess?
Yeah, technology is amazing. So what happened was, a couple of years ago, as a group of Rett parents, we raised some money and we had this amazing lady come out from America. And she and also the people with Rett syndrome in the UK have developed this eye gaze communication device. So this lady, Susan, came out and she set up her eye gaze, a bit like your monitor for your computer, had it up on the desk, and we each had 1 hour appointments with the Susan, and I'd never seen this thing working. So we bring Charlotte in, we sit her down in the chair, and Susan says, you can sit to one side, whereas I'm getting ready to help Charlotte. So we sit to one side, and she reads Charlotte a book, and she said to Charlotte, which was your favourite page? Did you like it when the dog rolled in the mud? Or anyway, Charlotte looks up at the screen and immediately finds the picture of whatever her favourite page was. I think it was when a boy had a cap on his head and he took it off and he was quite handsome underneath. And that was the picture. So Susan and Charlotte had this conversation with Charlotte using her eyes. And I'd never seen anything like it. And she was quick and fast and accurate.
How extraordinary.
It was.
Could you go further with that? Like, can she generate conversations from that, or is it still a responsive, like she's shown options with
that
technology?
Oh, she can generate conversations, yes. So at the moment we don't have one of these machines, but she hangs out with other girls who do, and when they're having a rest or something, she'll have a turn. And I went to a bit of an open day at one of the houses last year, and one of the girls' machines was in front of Charlotte, and the machine suddenly said, "Nice dress." And I'm thinking, nice dress. And I'm looking around and I realise someone's just arrived with a really pretty floral dress, and I hadn't even seen the person arrive. Out of the corner of her eye, she's seen the person arrive and she's commented, nice dress.
So that was Charlotte through the machine.
Nice dress.
What kind of personality have you discovered through this machine, or what aspects of Charlotte's character that maybe you weren't so aware of before? Has it shown a different side
Sarah,
your daughter to you?
Yes, definitely. I think that I've underestimated her a lot. To notice something as minor as someone walking in a room and never in 21 years being able to say, you look pretty or something, that's a horrible thing to live with. And to understand her frustration, not only that she doesn't get Milo or orange juice, but to be able to comment and be part of society. But I think I've always known she's a terrible flirt, but I think that's allowed me to see that even more, which I don't take credit for. She doesn't mind a good-looking boy. And I think it's allowed me to see her sense of humour. She's always come across as having a sense of humour, but I think when she has the device, you're able to see that that's more than you would expect for someone who's probably in pain most of the day and frustrated, but she laughs at life, which is amazing.
It's such an extraordinary window into her world, Sam, but did it come with a kind of mixed reaction for you? On the one hand, wow, we're seeing this, but then, oh my gosh, we missed this for all these years.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that surprised me is I was worried what she might say. Like, for example, she might not want to do any of the things I offer or eat any of the food or like me at all. And that's not the case. And I think the patience and the resilience of someone with Rett syndrome or many disabilities could teach us all a few lessons in life, because she isn't spoiled in what she wants. She's reasonable and she's understanding and she's lovely, and I think that that was a surprise. You would think after all these years she's going to get really demanding, but not the case.
You say you don't have one of these sort of miraculous-sounding devices at home. Why not?
Well, the NDIS has been an amazing thing, but leading up to the NDIS has been coming for an awfully long time. So, and a lot of other parents will relate to this, where you may have applied for help financially for your child, but because the NDIS was coming, everything was on lockdown. So back, she's 21 now, but back when that Susan Norwell thing happened, we applied for a device through the current channels at that time, and we were told we were approved and that there was a waiting list, and then when our name came up, we would get one. So we were so excited. I've still got that letter. It's quite crumpled now. And then we were told, well, look, the NDIS is coming, so you'll get your device through that funding. Then when the NDIS came and we are on the NDIS, we were told, well, actually, you have to reapply because it's a different bucket of money. So we went to another session and we did another application. And, you know, when we sat down to have the assessment for the fourth time it's been, Charlotte's first thing that she said with the machine was, why? Like, we had virtually just sat down in our seats and the word why rings through the room, and I realised that's what she's chosen. Why? Why are we here? I've shown you I can use this.
So you're waiting on the money, basically.
Yeah, we're waiting on the approval, but we have made the decision as a family that by the time her birthday comes around in March, if we haven't been approved, then we will buy her one. The original ones were about $30,000, so a lot of money. But now, as you know, technology is getting smaller, so they've got smaller and smaller. So I think now it'd be about a lot cheaper anyway.
Now that she has these ways of communicating and you're more sensitive to what she's capable of and what her needs are, does she still have those tantrums when you're out at the shopping centre or the pool?
The thing about the communication is that it's, you need the device in front of you to be able to communicate, which is tricky. And also, as the carer, you need to be able to know when it is needed and have it ready. And, you know, so for me, as someone using it, I would have to be a lot better at it than I am now. I'm going to have to really get good at it too. That Susan was quick and fast. Well, one, we don't have it, but if we did have it, a situation happened where we took her to the swimming pool recently, and she loves the pool near us, but it was closed. So we took her to a nearby one. Well, the change room was hot, the floor was slippery, there was no chair to sit on, and it didn't smell so great. Well, the second we got in there, she just exploded. Now, I don't know if I could have, what could I have done with the communication device there? I could have said beforehand, we're going into this change room and I don't think you're going to like it. What do you want to do? But we've got to change her.
So how did you handle, I mean, because she's now 21, she's an adult. Yeah. How was that physically?
Yes, it's a matter of quickly bundling her in the car, which is no mean feat. Yeah,
do you need another adult to help?
Generally, I do. I had a carer with me that day, but she was quite intimidated by Charlotte's behaviour, and you have to be pretty army regimented, you know? Quickly get her in the car. Don't stand in front of her because you'll lose your hair, and don't put your hands in front of her because she'll bite you. You know, you have to be really quick and get her in the car, and we've got a few carers who are amazing, but this young lady was quite new and she was absolutely beautiful, but it's overwhelming.
What about the people watching at the pool?
Well, I must admit, I used to care a lot about them, and I used to do the polite, probably politician smile or something. But now, you know what? I don't really care. I want my daughter to be safe and happy, and that's the most important thing. And if they, for 5 minutes, were inconvenienced, well, so be it. But I do worry about particularly young people, one, worrying, going home and saying, "Mummy, what were they doing to that girl?" So I feel a need to reassure young people and say, she's okay, she's just having a bad day. So if I see a 8-year-old little girl staring with huge wide eyes, I do take a moment to say, she's okay, she's just having a bad day.
I wonder, Sam, if you can remember yourself before you had a child with special needs. What were your thoughts about disability? Or if you encountered someone like Charlotte out in the world, what would have you made of that?
Well, I think that I was very much like 99% of the population. You don't know whether looking is nice or that's classed as staring. So I never knew. I think that I would never have felt that just saying hello was okay. I would have felt like, oh, better to just look away, or do you smile? I think that unknown cloud over disability is too huge. I'd love to see that debunked a little bit. I'd love us all to know that really you can look them straight in the eye and say hello. You haven't hurt anyone. If they don't want to say hello or they can't, they'll just keep going. I think that the person before was confused as what to do, whereas the person now, I really make sure I say hello to everyone, actually. Say hello to everybody.
You said that Charlotte, when it's the right pool, enjoys swimming. What yes. else makes her happy?
Yeah. Ed Sheeran. So Ed, if you're out there, this young girl here, very keen on you. She loves that. There's one particular Ed Sheeran song, and if you put that on, her whole demeanour changes, and it's beautiful. So it's a little overplayed in our house. She loves people, so she loves gossip. So if you and I were to go and have a coffee now and we just talked about everybody for an hour, she would think it was the bee's knees. So she loves that, and she loves her friends.
So what's a typical day for Charlotte?
She has the best life now. School wasn't so successful. She didn't love it. But now on, say, for example, let's take Monday just gone. A carer would pick her up at 9 o'clock and take her wheelchair in the back of her car. They would drive to the Acacia Ridge ice rink. The carer would put Charlotte in her wheelchair. The carer would put ice skates on, and they would skate around the rink for an hour with all of her friends there, the music, modern music going, good-looking boys to look at, and then they'd come out of the rink, have some lunch or morning tea, the friends together, and then she'd be dropped home about 2, 2:30. She loves it.
When you think about her future, what plans are you making for that?
Yeah, we've thought about it a lot and worried about it a lot because obviously we're getting older. And although her dad and I still get on, we're no longer married. We're both remarried, and we are both building houses to encompass Charlotte's future. So we've both arranged separate areas with her own living area and her own little bedroom and kitchenette so that as we get older, she'll be able to have carers come and take her ice skating without relying on us doing the showering and the physical stuff, but we can still make sure she's okay.
So you have written many books for kids, Sam, but this latest book, Everything I've Never Said, is where you're imagining what it might be like to have Rett syndrome. What was it like for you to imaginatively put yourself inside the head of a girl like your daughter?
It was tricky, I think, in that I don't think I dare imagine how difficult it is, but it was a very wonderful experience to look at the world and say to yourself, if I couldn't speak, how would I tell Mum that I really don't want to wear purple? And then to sit at my desk and imagine being dressed in a colour that I absolutely loathed and not being able to do anything about it. I think it was we talk about mindfulness. I think it was mindfulness times 100 because it was every decision and every movement trying to think the consequences of not being able to say what you wanted.
I wonder if imaginatively putting yourself in Charlotte's position is something you've been doing your whole life, or her whole life, or has it been almost something you haven't dared let yourself fully
inhabit? Definitely done it. It's caused many sleepless nights. I think that one of the things that happens in the book is the little girl gets sent to respite for the weekend, and that's one of the hardest things a parent can do. And you know you need it, and you know your family needs it, but to worry every second of the time they're not under your care, and you do almost have to turn that off. So I've turned it on to be able to write the book, but in order to survive life, if you think that too much, it's too mind-blowing. You know, you worry, is someone going to drop her today? And what if they don't know she's thirsty? It's really hot today. And what if the aircon's blasting on her? Has anyone thought she might be cold? And, you know, you can worry about everything, and it's not healthy.
Was Charlotte involved in the writing of this story at all?
Definitely, she's definitely been consulted whether she could actually tell me she agreed or not. So I would say to her, for example, I'd say, you know, I'm going to have this scene where you're at the pool and you're all floppy because I know you love the pool. And, you know, do you get fed up when your teacher says time's up? You do. You get fed up, don't you, Charlotte? And she'd just look at me with a little smile, and I just have to go, I think she'd be fed up, you know. And she really did pay attention. It was lovely.
Was Charlotte at the book launch?
Yes, yes. And Sarah, you know, you mentioned before how I dealt with her difficult behaviour, and one of the things I did, I suppose, was hide her away from my career. So I wouldn't take her to any of the bookstores I visited for my previous books. I didn't take her to many things. But one thing I did take her to was to my publishers to collect my first 6 copies of the book. And her whole demeanour was so fabulous. I thought, right, I'm going to take her to the book launch. And the morning of the book launch, she was horrible. We got her up. She was didn't want breakfast. I think she threw her drink across the floor. She screamed. And my husband and I looked at each other and go, what are we going to do? We've said to everyone we're bringing, we've invited all the other Rett girls that we know. We've decked the place out in purple, which is the colour of Rett syndrome charities. You know, Charlotte's got to come. So we had about 6 scenarios of what we would do. Anyway, I went on ahead, set up the room, and I'm watching my phone thinking he's going to cancel, he's not going to bring her, it's all a disaster. And my husband's incredibly proud of me. So for him to have missed it would have been horrible too. So it was going to be a double whammy if they couldn't come. Anyway, up the lift he comes, and out she comes, and his face is like thunder, and he's looking at me, sweat on his brow, and she sees the purple balloon, she sees some of her friends, and she puts on the party face, and she hasn't looked so happy ever. So we were there for about 2 hours. She didn't stop smiling, but the absolute best bit was when I gave my little speech. She made these little noises all the way through, and then I said, I'm going to read a little bit. And I said to the audience, would you like me to read a little bit? And she just made this really loud, positive sound, and I went, oh, you do you? Sort of half joking. Anyway, the bit I read, the little girl in the book, Ava, doesn't like somebody staring at her, so she reaches over and she pulls the blonde hair of this girl staring, and the mum says, I'm really sorry, Ava didn't mean it. And in her head, Ava says, I did mean it, and I'll do it again in a flash. And when I finished saying that, Charlotte just burst out laughing, and I think the whole room was in tears because they knew she knew, and it was amazing. It was amazing. That was Charlotte saying, I love you, Mum, and I'll never forget it. It was incredible. It was incredible. With every cell in her body, she was proud of me, and I've never had a situation like that with her. And it was, the book was hard to write, but I'll never regret having written it for that moment.
Sam, congratulations.
Thank you.
What a treat to speak with you on Conversations.
Thanks, Sarah.
Samantha Wheeler, and Sam's novel, inspired by her life with her daughter, is called Everything I've Never Said. This conversation will be up on our website shortly, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.